Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love mine. Mine also does chilled filtered water and sparkling filtered water too. It's an amazing bit of kit. I like them. I like the company. I like the company ethos. For more information and to look at the different models, go to the website cooker.co.uk. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. I actually love the fact that they sponsor this podcast. I'm really proud of the fact that I've got such a good sponsor. Love it. Really makes me happy. Today's hour, I'm curious about how to disagree, an important subject for the age we live in. It seems no one can agree on anything anymore. Everyone seems to dig their heels in. Maybe it's always been like that and we're just see it more now because of social media. To join me in the conversation about this is Ian Leslie, who's written a book called How to Disagree, Lessons on Productive Conflict at Work and at Home. I think we probably all need to understand this. Let me tell you a bit about Ian before we meet him. Ian Leslie is a journalist and author of two acclaimed books on human behavior, Born Liars and Curious. His first career was in advertising. I always wanted to work in advertising. I thought that would be good, coming up with slogans and ideas and concepts. Anyway, his first career was in advertising, where he worked as a strategist for some of the world's biggest brands at ad agencies in London and New York. He now counsels business leaders on communication and writes about psychology, technology, politics, and business for The New Statesman, The Economist, Guardian, and The Financial Times. He's the co-host of a podcast series, Polarized, on the way we do politics today. Oh, that'd be interesting. Ian is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. He lives in London. There you go. This is that's Ian. Let's meet him. Here is Ian. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Tim.
Thank you very much for joining me this morning. I was just doing reading out your biography for my listeners in the introduction, and it's got quite a colourful life. You started in advertising.
I did, yeah. I worked in advertising for a long time, and in fact I still do some work in advertising, but it was my full-time career for about 15 years after I left university, and I had a lot of fun. Yeah, go on.
I've always said I wanted to work in advertising. It seems like it's a really exciting industry to work in. It feels very creative. And it feels like it's very much influences what the public are thinking. Would I be correct in saying that?
Yes, I think so. But I would caveat it by saying I think the idea that people who work in advertising are sort of Machiavellian, brilliant manipulators of the consumer is not quite right either. Often they or we just don't know what we're doing. We're kind of throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what works. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's hugely fun. There's lots of creative people in it. It's a very colourful industry. It's also a little bit silly, to be honest. And after 10 or 15 years of doing something that I thought was great fun, and I worked in New York for a few years, so it got me around the world a bit. I thought, is this something that I really, really care about deep down? Or has it been huge fun and maybe I want to try something else now? So I had a kind of an early midlife crisis. It's good to get them in, good to get them in early and often. You just kind of think about why am I doing this? What are my goals here? And I thought, I want to change career. I want to at least try and make a transition to being a writer, because I really do care about writing and doing it really well. And there's lots of ideas that I want to write about that don't fit within the world of advertising. So I sort of changed horses midstream and have been gradually doing, getting a writing career off the ground. It's now fully off the ground, but it took me a while to get off the ground. Whilst doing still doing some freelance in advertising, but yeah, it's I still have some affection for it, but I didn't want to do it forever.
Did you used to have to sit down with the companies then and say, what is our ethos here? Is that the kind of the way it used to go? What do we, like, we are a deodorant, but what do we stand for? We stand for world peace and environmental issues. Was it a bit like that? Are those meetings?
There's a lot of meetings like that. There's a lot of meetings talking about, what's the brand personality, you know, of this breakfast cereal or this deodorant, and we're going to put up lots of words on a chart that describe in minute detail this, as if it's some incredibly sort of complex person, you know, in the room, when in fact it's just a cereal brand with a cartoon character on the front of it. And whilst all that stuff is quite fun, after a while it starts to just feel a little bit of an absurd way to spend your life. And the absurdity of it got to me after a while.
So are you getting nourishment now out of writing?
Yeah, and I'm now kind of, I'm it's not actually a million miles from what I was doing, because I was the guy doing what you were just talking about, kind of helping with the strategy. You know, who are we talking to? What are we saying here? And that involves a lot of thinking about people and about culture and about why people buy things and why. And in my writing, I'm still writing. I'm not writing about advertising anymore, or not much. I am writing about human behavior. I'm writing about, you know, why do people? My first book was about lying. Why do people lie? Let's find out everything I can find out about that, and tell a story around it, or tell, you know, put several stories around it, and make it a book for the general reader to access a whole load of interesting expertise and ideas about lying. But the book after that was about curiosity. So why are people curious? Why is it good to be a curious person? Why do people become incurious? How can you stop yourself becoming incurious? How can you keep your curiosity going over a lifetime? And then the last book, the book that we're talking about today, is about disagreement and conflict. You know, why are we so bad at it? Why do we avoid it? How can we get better at it? What are the benefits of it? I take an aspect of human behavior and I look at it in the round.
I want to get into your book in a minute, but just very quickly on advertising, is there one campaign that you think is absolutely amazing? I once pitched an idea, the 10 best marketing campaigns or advertising campaigns of all time, including De Beers for the diamonds and the engagement ring. Red Bull, I thought, was amazing, their campaign. Marlboro was amazing, was getting everybody to smoke and using the cowboy. And what was the other one? Oh gosh, what did I say? Red Bull. Yeah, I said Red Bull, didn't I? There's one other that I thought of that was absolutely, it'll come back to me, but is there one that you think was absolutely phenomenal advertising campaign or marketing campaign? Oh, I know the one, Barack Obama, when he started doing his, you know, very simple images and went online and stuff. I thought that was incredible what he did back then. Is there any that you really like?
There's many, it's almost sort of too many to mention. But, you know, I loved the when I was just kind of coming into advertising, or just probably before I came into advertising, but when I was a teenager, I think, with the classic Levi's campaign, starting with Nick Kamen walking into a laundrette and taking his jeans off and putting them in a washing machine, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. You know, that was one of the kind of ads that inspired me and made me think, wow, I want to work in this industry. It's so much fun. And then they did a whole series of ads like that, which all had great soundtracks and were all super cool. I would say, you know, one of the campaigns that I really like, somewhat underrated, but it was around for years and years and years, only recently came to an end, was the Jack Daniels campaign that you used to see on the tube and on posters, where it was just sort of pictures of, you know, old guys talking about how they made whiskey. And it seemed like such a sort of like small, dull premise for a campaign. But I read every one of those and it made the brands feel so kind of romantic and interesting and funny, and it had such a strong personality. And it was just the same thing over and over and over again with variations, but they were all good variations. And there's something to be said for that kind of consistency, you know, over years and years and years. And I think it was incredibly powerful campaign. But all good things must come to an end. And recently they cut it and they've replaced it with something very boring. But yeah, there's we could talk about this all day. I mean, there's lots of, fewer these days actually, because we'd passed the kind of golden age of TV advertising, but there were so many kind of amazing TV ads in the 80s and 90s, early 2000s.
So Ian, why is it that you care about humans and their behavior? What drew you to that?
You know, that's just my, you know, I wrote a book about curiosity. That is just the thing that I'm curious about. I just love talking about and thinking about people and why they do stuff, why we're so crazy, you know, why we do stuff that is perverse or odd, you know, like this is what started me writing about lying. Why do we lie, or why do we need to lie? Why can't we just tell the truth? And then I also love ideas. So I love kind of, you know, talking to really smart, you know, psychologists or philosophers or historians and saying, you know, what is it about lying or curiosity? Like, how has that changed over the years, or what's the neuroscience of it? I'm just, you know, I just somebody who loves, you know, asking these questions, and then I love kind of putting them together into stories and really kind of communicating my enthusiasm for it, my curiosity for it to other people.
Yeah. So why write a book on how to disagree?
Well, I mean, that actually started, I tell you the germ of it was, and this happens sometimes, I get commissioned to write a piece for a newspaper, and it sort of stimulates an idea for a book in my mind. So, and it wasn't a piece about disagreements, it was a piece about something else, but it fed into the book. The piece was about interrogation. I had come across this brilliant guy who called Lawrence Allison, who trains the police in interrogation, trains counter-terrorist police, right? He's probably the world's sort of foremost expert on the science of interrogation, because it really is a science. It's been studied many, you know, huge kind of literature on it. But this is a guy who gives very practical advice. You know, he talks to the police and says, this is how you do it. And I spent a long time with him, and I talked to the police, you know, expert interrogators in the police. And I found the whole subject so fascinating, so interesting, because it seemed to bring wider kind of knowledge than just about interrogation. What they were really talking about was how to have difficult conversations. How do you talk to somebody who doesn't want to talk to you? You know, how do you talk to somebody who hates you? How do you talk to somebody if you hate them, right? Maybe, you know, often these interrogators are walking into the room and they're talking to really, really terrible people, frankly, people who may have tried to kill them or kill their colleagues or people they know. And they have to sit in that room and they have to find a way of being curious about them. They have to kind of say, they have to try and understand what's going on in their mind and in their life, because it's only by doing that will they get them to talk. And the more I found out about it, the more I thought, you know what? There's universal wisdom here just for any kind of difficult conversation. And then that thought connected up with some other thoughts I've been having, which was, why is social media discourse so toxic? Why are we having all these terrible conflict and, you know, disagreements in our public life? We must be able to get better at it. And I started to think, you know what? Nobody trains you how to disagree well. Nobody trains you how to have a really tough, conflicted conversation, but we're having more and more of them because there are more and more people out there with a voice. There's more and more people out there with strong opinions. We're bound to have more and more clashes of views, but because we're not prepared for it, because nobody comes along and says, look, this is how you can disagree with somebody without falling out and actually have a productive disagreement, because that doesn't happen, what do? Most of us avoid it, right? Most of us just say, oh, difficult conversation or a disagreement, life's too short, I'm going to back away from this one. And then what happens when you avoid a disagreement or a conflict? It doesn't go away. It festers, goes underground, becomes transmuted into resentment or passive aggression, and just kind of makes things worse. So I made it the mission of my book and now, you know, a lot of my life actually, is to say to people, let's get better at disagreement. Let's have our disagreements out in the open, but let's do it productively and constructively. Let's do it passionately, but let's do it constructively and with a view to kind of making ourselves smarter, rather than seeing it as a fight to the death. Most of the time it's presented as this kind of zero-sum game where it's like, I have to crush this person in the disagreement or they're going to crush me. That's completely futile, toxic, stupid. It literally makes you stupid. And the other, it makes all of us stupid. But if we don't do it at all, we put it aside, we're also going to make ourselves stupid. So we need to find a way to disagree in a way that's going to make us smarter. And that's really what the book's about. It's a very long answer.
I love it. And I love the book, by the way. I learned a lot, which is important. Both of us have just finished watching PMQs. We're both interested in politics. You've got a podcast on it. Boris Johnson was just doing his taking some questions after Rishi and Javid have just resigned. And it made me think, actually, because I was doing this interview, I get so frustrated with the House of Parliament, because it's so childish. And everyone I speak to, politician, I've interviewed a load of politicians on this, they always say, isn't it wonderful that the idea you're holding the PM accountable? It's like, no, it's not. It's childish the way it's delivered. The jeering over each other, the sarcasm, the trying to win a point. And, you know, in your book, it's these constant examples of not doing that to get a meaningful conversation. And yet the place, the people who are running our country are acting like small children. We would not let our children behave that way. I think it's time for that to change. I despair watching it every week when I watch it. Do you feel the same, or do you feel it has a place?
Let's put it this way. It's an example of what happens when a disagreement becomes is essentially just a status battle, you know, a wrestling match, right? It's a performance, and it's not intended to shed light, or to get to the truth, right? That's not its function at all. And so it's quite useful in the context of our conversation or my book as an example of what to avoid in your life, right? Because in your life, when you have a disagreement with someone, whether it's your partner or a home or a colleague at work or whatever it is, you should be looking to have the disagreement in a way that helps you find some truth that you wouldn't find if you were just thinking through things for yourself, or you know, helps you get an insight into how the other person feels and things. And if you go into the disagreement and you treat it like politicians in the House of Commons debating chamber, you're just like, I'm going to show how clever I am and win this argument by being, you know, showing all my brilliant rhetorical skills and then humiliating this person, cruelly crushing them. I mean, yeah, if that's what you want to do, fine. But from the truth, from the point of view of getting anything intelligent or creative or interesting or insightful, complete waste of time.
Yeah, it's when Jacob Rees-Mogg stood up not so long ago, well, I don't know, a year or so ago, and started saying, my school's better than your school. I was like, oh, really? And you've still got a job in politics? Is this honestly how we're going to act? I find the whole thing astonishing, because the thing is, you actually for a while you live it and just accept it as normal. And then I got invited to go and watch it one day, and when you actually go in and watch PMQs, you get to see how pathetic it is. Grown men and women, as supposed adults, just go rah, 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 shouting and screaming at each other and all trying to get. I just found the whole thing so ludicrous that these people are running our country. And I was always thinking, if it was a load of lawyers standing there or doctors or accountants, you'd be going, what are this lot? You know, or pilots, you'd be going, I don't want them to fly my plane. And yet we allow politicians to do that ridiculous facade constantly. I don't know. Winds me up no end. Ian, what really are arguments then? Do you think, are they control? Are they status? Or is it a combination?
Well, they can be. And this is the thing. We are, when from an evolutionary point of view, we're not particularly well designed to have a constructive disagreement, because, you know, in the context in which we kind of evolved, and our brains evolved, if somebody was disagreeing with you, it's probably because they were about to kill you, or, you know, hit you with a block of a piece of rock. And in fact, when they put people in brain scanners and fMRI scanners, and they kind of show people, you know, disagreeing or disagreeable statements, the parts of the brain that light up are the same parts of the brain that light up when people feel under physical threat, right? So when somebody disagrees with you, And that your chest, you can feel it physically, right? Your shoulders go up a bit, your chest tightens a little bit, and your heartbeat increases. That's because your body is readying itself for an assault. And part of the, one of the things you have to learn, one of the principles you have to learn if you want to make this disagreement be productive and actually helpful, is to be aware of that reaction and say, well, you know, it's all right. You're not actually under attack here. And try and separate the thing that you're disagreeing about from you. And because that's the big confusion that we make, is we're having this argument about this thing, but I feel like I'm being attacked. Now, sometimes you are, by the way. So let's keep that in mind. But they're not always the same thing, and a lot of the time they're not. But we feel that they are. So try to separate the thing that we're arguing about from the way I'm feeling about this relationship that's happening with this person in the room is absolutely crucial to doing it well.
There's a comedian called Norm MacDonald who said, you know, opinions, there's a lot of opinions now. He said, I'm misquoting him here, but he said something like, the average man used to have like three opinions. And now, you know, there's like, if someone had five opinions, you'd call them opinionated. Now, everyone's got an opinion on everything. And he said, and then he starts going on about it like that. And I thought that was quite funny because it does feel like you have to have if a subject comes along, whatever it is, Brexit, I don't know, I don't want to give any more examples, but if any subject comes up, what's your opinion on it? It's like, oh Christ, I've got to have an opinion. And you know, you don't really have to have an opinion, but we do these days have to have an opinion, don't we? Seems that there's more opinions. Yeah. Is this correct?
That is absolutely brilliant. I'm going to look that riff up from Norm MacDonald, because I wholeheartedly agree with it. I think it's one of the great problems with the modern age, is that we all feel like we have to have opinions and beliefs. You don't have to have beliefs about, you know, lots of different things. You don't have to have strong opinions about lots of, the fewer opinions and beliefs you have, the better, right? Just don't worry about all that stuff. Live your life and be receptive to whatever's happening, and don't feel like you have to kind of spout about everything, and we'll all be a lot happier anyway. The fact of the matter is, it is, you know, people do feel like that, and not only do they feel like that, they have the technology to voice their opinion and to broadcast it, you know, to everyone instantly, which, you know, and it's like we've a child being given a machine gun. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, we're not ready for this. We're not, as a species, remotely evolved culturally or neurologically for a world in which everybody can voice their opinion to everybody all the time instantly. And no wonder the world's gone a bit haywire, because, you know, it's just like, whoa, what do we do with this thing? You know, just learning to live in a world where there's going to be more disagreement, and you're going to see more disagreeable opinions than ever, but without being triggered by it, and whilst, you know, maintaining your composure is a skill that I think we all have to learn a bit.
Yeah, in your book, you also talk about the difference between cultures, and I suppose we come in contact much more with our traveling and also with the internet, with other cultures now. And there's some good diagrams about that, the way we deal with conflicts in there, but also just the different way we actually argue, I suppose, in different cultures.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, very broadly speaking, cultures from the East, from Asian cultures, are much more conflict averse. And they're much more likely to rely on kind of traditions and norms to guide the conversation. You know, if they're sitting around a table debating a decision, there's very little kind of direct disagreement or questioning. Everything's kind of quite subtle, and people kind of defer to whoever is in authority. So they send signals, but they don't have direct disagreements. In more Western cultures, you know, particularly the US, obviously, and the UK, much more likely to have a disagreement, and you're also much more likely to just spell out, articulate your opinions verbally using lots of words, rather than just sort of relying on nods and winks and kind of oblique signs of where you stand. And so inevitably in those kind of cultures, Western cultures, you get a lot more disagreement, and you get a lot more kind of passion and heat in the conversation as well. And sometimes when you get, there's sometimes kind of culture clashes where you get people from different types of argumentative cultures, you know, meeting each other, and they, you know, the Asian person thinks that the Western people are incredibly aggressive and rude, and the Western people think that the Asian people are just not saying anything, and or you know, being kind of deliberately mysterious or oblique and so on. So there can be lots of misunderstanding. But even, you know, not just across different countries, but even within any room, in any workplace, you will find some sort of misunderstanding or kind of microcultural clash between people who have different ideas of what a good disagreement looks like. So just kind of thinking about, you know, people's different attitudes to disagreement and thinking, well, that person might be more wary of disagreeing than I am, or that person might be, they might love disagreeing and arguing in a way that I don't. Bearing that in mind is an important part of doing it well.
Yeah, and I suppose you got me thinking about that. There's an accepted position often. So say we go right back to where the population of the country was a million or something, or a couple of million. In your tribe or your village or whatever, you would have an accepted opinion. Every now and then some would say, hold on, shouldn't we just go and fight the neighbours and take all their whatever? But generally people would have their accepted opinion. But now we've opened up with we're all multiculturalism, globalisation, and also the internet. The accepted opinion now is changing constantly, as you say, because people have different cultures and different views on life. So now the accepted position is very different amongst lots of people, and it's and then we're now, I suppose, all arguing constantly what the accepted position is.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right, you know, we now live in democracies, or some of us do. We live in cities, you know, with incredibly diverse populations. We're surrounded by and amongst people at home and at work from very different backgrounds, culturally, ethnically, philosophically, and everybody, you know, and we have these egalitarian societies which everybody feels, you know, they and does have the right to talk, to speak, and we've only been in these kinds of societies for, you know, what, 300 years, you know, the blink of an eyelid, really, in historical terms. For the last 50,000 years, you know, as you say, most things were settled either by the very powerful people at the top or just culturally. You lived in kind of, you know, monocultural societies. Now we're in these kind of multicultural, multi-traditional, and multi-ideological, incredibly gloriously diverse societies, and inevitably there's a huge amount of more differing views and disagreements. But our cultural and sort of neurological evolutionary kind of equipment hasn't kept up. So it's no wonder we're so bad at disagreement and conflict. No wonder we try and avoid it, or when we do, we kind of crash into it and you know, really annoy each other. We're just unprepared for this world that we live in, that's been accelerated at warp speed by the internet and by social media in the last sort of 10, 20 years. So really, my book is this kind of small attempt. You know, how to disagree is a small attempt to kind of say, okay, guys, we do actually need to think about this. You know, how are we going to disagree well? Because there's a lot of it about, and you know, we haven't really kind of trained ourselves in it. So let's start doing that.
Yeah, I've got my twins home at the moment. They're both at university, both studying. Well, one's history and politics, the other one's politics and anthropology, and both of them are discussing constantly American politics. And it always occurs to me that when I was a kid growing up, literally had no idea what Reagan was talking about. Whatever, I mean, kind of did a bit, but their politics didn't really cross over to me. I was more interested in what was going on over here. But the world's become a bit smaller. We seem to be obsessed with American politics. Everybody seems more intrigued by Donald Trump or Joe Biden than they actually do what's going on over here. It's really weird how we've become engrossed in their politics, don't you think?
I think it is a bit weird. And I say this as somebody who is interested in American politics and has been ever since I was like 11, 12 years old, right? So in a way, I'm a complete kind of American politics nerd. However, I'm increasingly the view that just we are collectively way too interested in American politics and culture. And in fact, a lot of our political debates, a lot of our cultural debates you know, over in inverted commas, wokeness and so on, right, seem to be imported from America. And it's not just that we're less interested in Britain. We also just seem to be completely uninterested in France or Germany or Italy, our European neighbours. And people are always pitching into American political debates from this side of the Atlantic. And I'm like, don't worry about America. Let them do their thing. I mean, obviously, we have to worry about it to some extent because they're very powerful and they're our ally and so on. We don't have to get involved in, you know, discussions over what legislation the Florida State Senate has just passed. You know, it's completely ridiculous. Yeah. And no, these things do not kind of then immediately become British law. No, no, Britain has a very, very difficult, different political culture to the US. If I was starting again now, I'd say to my younger self, why don't you actually learn about French politics? Why don't you learn about German politics? They're our neighbors. We're much more tightly bound up with them than we are with America. It's a weird kind of, it's like we've kind of been colonized by them culturally and politically. I think we need to kind of shrug it off a bit.
Why were you so interested in American politics at such a young age?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess the you know, it always seems like it's much sort of bigger. It's like watching this incredible kind of Technicolor movie after you've been watching the small black and white TV of British politics, or it's like, you know, when I lived in New York for a few years, and this was just shortly before the kind of rise of Obama and so on. And I was just thinking, God, it's just so much bigger. Everything's bigger, for better and for worse, right? Money, fame, glamour, entertainment, religion, like the whole thing is just huge,
violence.
Garish. Violence. Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of repellent and incredibly compelling at the same time. And I remember coming back to Britain, and it was during the New Labour years, and there was lots of kind of newspaper stories about Tony and Gordon bickering with each other. And I'm like, my God, this is like a parish council. You know, this just feels so kind of small and inconsequential. Of course, now I learned that to like that, you know, actually like the fact that our politics are or have been less dramatic and less crazy than America, because we've seen what happens when America goes so crazy that they start doing things like electing Donald Trump. They're very, very different political cultures.
Did you live in New York? Is that where you were based?
Yeah, I lived in New York. Yeah,
I love America. How long did you live there for?
4 years.
Sorry, I missed that.
Oh, 4 years.
4 years. Everyone always says, where's the best place to go on holiday? And I always say America. The reason being is that I remember arriving in LA, in Chicago, San Francisco, and New York being the most poignant of them all. You arrive there, and I arrived there, and it was kind of cold, and there was the steam coming out of the hydrants and stuff, and then there's a cab driver, and then they route to you in the deli and stuff. And it's like, it's just like the movies. It was like my Disneyland. I could not believe how exciting it was, and I sort of agree with you. It felt big, it felt exciting, and because we get so much of their culture over here, don't we, that I absolutely adored it. Did you enjoy living there?
I loved it. I mean, I really had the time of my life there. It was very good, a very exciting place to live. And also particularly fun to be an English person in New York. The English accent, for some reason, still carries some residual kind of glamour or interest in the US and in New York. And it's funny how much I played up to it, because I know when I went out there, I talked like somebody who grew up in South London. I grew up in Southeast London. So I talked a bit, you know, I talked like that, right? A little bit like, by the time I came back from New York, I was talking like Hugh Grant. You know, I was like, oh, bugger. Yes, of course. Yes, I'm so sorry. And I realized, you know, I'd really been playing up to this image that they have of the English person. And actually, it's interesting, because when you live abroad, you do start to realize how much you owe to your native country. So when I was there, I did feel more English. I felt more European, actually. I realized what it means to be a European, just a sense of being part of an older culture. Not necessarily something you can't walk around thinking about, but it imbues your sensibility in a way that you didn't realize until you're in this crazy kind of young kind of upstart culture of America. But yeah, I had a fabulous time. I had to come home because I was having too good a time.
That's really interesting, actually. It's interesting you changed the way you spoke. I interviewed Vidal Sassoon a couple of times, and he's one of my heroes. And what I love about Vidal Sassoon is he went to work with Ramon, the famous coiffeur, and he went in there and said, can I have a job? And Ramon said, no, you can't, because I think his name was Ramon, because you've got a, you know, you sound like a Cockney barrow boy. And rather than Vidal Sassoon go, well, this is the way I talk, I'm not changing for you, I'm going to prove you wrong, he went away and got elocution lessons. And he also got lessons on tone, which is what I could do with. And what was fascinating about that is he thought if he was, he always had these visions that he was going to be something big in the world. And he realized that he needed to speak in a language that the world could appreciate. And the better his English was, the better he would be able to be understood by everybody. And he went and changed. If you listen to the way he speaks, it is wonderful, but he does have this wonderful tone where he goes down a lot in his voice when he says something interesting. And I really thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thought that was fantastic. So is it interesting that the way you did it naturally went, okay, this is the way I need to speak. If I'm going to have world domination in New York, I'm going to change the way I speak. Hugh Grant it is.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably quite common. We make these adjustments sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, to fit the environment that we're in. But yeah, it's fascinating. I'm fascinated by the voice, fascinated by tone, as you say, like and how powerful it is. You think, just going back to politics, how important it is. You know, politicians who are very compelling tend to have very good voices. It's just the sound of their voice, not necessarily their accent or what they're saying, but just they sound good. Like Barack Obama has a wonderful kind of baritone, and that really helps him more than perhaps you would realize. But it's really kind of, you know, helping him connect to people. And politicians who don't have good voices, you really kind of notice it. I did change to fit my environment. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to get on to the positives of arguing, disagreeing in a minute. But just before that, because you're talking about it now, words, I wonder how important words are. I remember reading a body language book years ago, and it sort of said, I'm making these figures up, but something like 10% of what you say is the actual words, then 30% is tone, and then 60% is body language. That is what you're projecting when you're speaking. And then I thought to myself, I wonder if that's when you're arguing, whether that's true as well, that you get angry, so your volume goes up, you know, your tone goes up, and your body language, as you said earlier, your chest comes out, and your pupils dilate as you get angrier, and the words are basically expletives often, but if they're not, they can be just absolutely meaningless, because now you're in a battle with each other, and it's more of a status thing. I wonder how important the words actually are in an argument.
Yeah, this is a great topic. One of the central models of my book of how to disagree, as it's now called, it was called Conflicted when it first came out. So we've now changed the title to be a bit more direct. It's called How to Disagree. And in How to Disagree, I talk about the fact that communication scientists will say, in any disagreement, actually any kind of difficult conversation, but in a disagreement, there are two levels of communication going on. There's the words, you know, the thing that we are talking about. You know, we're arguing about who does the more chores at home, right? If you are, or you're arguing about a decision that you're taking at work, right? There's that thing that you're, they call that the content level. And then there's underneath that, there's this unarticulated level, which isn't spelt out, which is about what you think about me, and what I think about you. Am I getting the respect that I deserve from you, or the affection that I deserve from you, and vice versa? And what happens is, in a difficult conversation, often that relationship level is really controlling the conversation. And the thing that we are talking about, it takes a back seat, because what we're engaged in is some sort of struggle to get the requisite amount of respect or liking or whatever it is. So settling that relationship level, being aware of it, just being tuned into it, is an incredibly important thing to do in a tough conversation. Just thinking, okay, this person evidently needs me to show that I really do like them, or I really do respect them. Maybe I can help with that, because I can say something. I can say, you know, I think you do most of the work around here, so you deserve a lot of respect for that, by the way. But I'm still going to disagree on this thing. But basically, unless you settle that relationship level somehow and you make that person feel a bit more secure, you put them at ease, and you do the same for yourself, you say, yeah, calm down, don't worry about it, you know, that, then only once you've done that can you get into the content stuff. So yeah, there's always this subterranean level which is kind of, you know, pushing up against the content level.
Talking of respect, Ian, full respect for this book. It must have taken you quite a while to compile, because it goes off on many different interesting, exciting tangents, and there seems to be a lot of research in it. Did it take a long time?
Yeah, I mean, it took about 3 years, I think.
That's commitment.
And I wanted it to be more than a theoretical, you know, primer. For it's got lots of interesting kind of psychology finds, you know, findings from science and psychology, communication science, and so on. But I also wanted it to be very practical. And part of my way of doing that was to go and talk to professionals, experts in difficult conversations in various different ways. So as you know, I spoke to interrogation experts. I've talked about, you know, I talked to hostage negotiators, talked to divorce mediators, addiction therapists, diplomats, you know, just people who do this stuff for a living and have got very, very, very good at it and haven't necessarily kind of written it all down and said, this is how we do it, but have this kind of incredible practical knowledge. And I wanted to draw on some of that. So that took quite a while to have those conversations, do those interviews, and then write it all down. But I'm really glad I did, because it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I love all the interrogation stuff. I think that's great. Give us an example of what you should do if you get involved in an argument, a heated argument with someone. How can you get the best out of one of those conversations?
Well, one of the principles is, I sort of just touched on it a minute ago. I call it first connect in the book. So first make a connection with a person that's not just about the disagreement. Find some other kind of human connection with that person, then get into it, right? So what I'm essentially saying is settle that relationship level as much as you can before you get to the content level. Just to draw a kind of one of my, in, you know, parallels from the world of hostage negotiation. Those guys are trained, the really good ones are trained, when they go into a hostage crisis situation, they don't pick up the phone to the hostage taker and immediately say, right, okay, how are we going to settle this situation? How are we going to get the hostages out, or whatever it is? You know, sometimes it's just talking someone off a roof. They are trained to spend the first few minutes just almost complimenting or flattering the person, or at least putting them at ease. So they'll say things like, hey, look, I just want you to know, we've all been impressed by the way you've been handling this so far. You've been fair and you've been calm, and we really appreciate that. Right. All they're doing is they're just trying to settle that person down. They're trying to just say, it's okay, I'm not here to crush you or humiliate you, make you look stupid. I'm here to kind of treat you as an equal in this conversation. Then they get into the tough stuff. Okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? Look, this applies to any conversation, right? Whether you're having a conversation with your wife, your husband, your kid, you know, sometimes, or somebody at work. One of the mistakes we make is we get into the tough stuff too quickly without kind of setting it up, without preparing the ground, without making that connection where you say, look, you know, I really respect you. You don't have to say in these words, but however you're going to say it, right? I really respect you and I like you and I think you've done great work here, or I know that you do most of the work here, or I know you're a good person, whatever it is. Then you say, okay, so look, but that's why I want to talk to you about this. That's going to be, if you sequence it in that way, that's much more likely to be much more a productive conversation, because that person's going to be feeling a little bit more at ease and less like they're going to feel less under threat. We talked about that feeling of being under threat. Once a person feels really threatened, they're never going to give you any ground. They're just going to come back and try and attack you. Yeah. And that leads to, you know, a toxic confrontation.
Disagreement it can also be great for things, can't it? You need disagreement because it changes the world. You know, if we all agree with each other, you know, and you mentioned it a myriad times in the book, it's important that people do disagree because they find other ways of doing things, don't they?
Oh, look, I mean, disagreement is basically the best way of thinking we have. It's the best way of reasoning and thinking and actually being creative too, right? When you're in a room with somebody and you really trust them and you can just talk to them about anything and you have a really good argument and you talk it through and you say, no, I think this. No, that's nonsense. What about this? What about this? You very quickly get rid of a lot of rubbish in both of your minds. It's almost like you're sweeping out each other's minds. Say, no, that's rubbish. That doesn't work. And you're trying to find like what the nub of this argument is, and you're trying to get down to the strongest arguments, right? And that's how everybody who's done anything really, really impressive, not everybody, but most people, that's how they have worked at various stages, right? From Socrates in the market square in Athens, you know, he sits down with people and he says, okay, what do you think? And he says, well, no, I think that's wrong. How about this? Socrates didn't write anything down because he didn't trust writing, because he couldn't talk back to it. He couldn't disagree with him. He said, you know, I like to do my thinking with people because they'll disagree with me and then that'll make me think harder about what to say next. And I think we need to recapture a bit of that spirit. We're often in workplaces where everybody's got this huge emphasis on being nice and getting along and not offending anybody, you know, a lot of which is fine and very nice. But if that means that you don't disagree with each other, then you're not really maximizing the talent and the brain power that's in the room. Because it's only when you're having a constructive disagreement that everybody really brings their best game to the table. And starts to kind of really bring out their best arguments, their best information, data, talks about their experiences. And whilst we have this incredible emphasis on diversity at work at the moment, which is good, if you have a group of diverse people sitting around a table and they all agree with each other, you know, what's the point of that?
You know, that is absolutely fascinating. This, that really is, because it's. When I first started in TV world years ago, quite a long time ago, 29 years or something ago, I'd be threatened to be sacked constantly and people be shouting and screaming. But the creativity back in the 90s was just unbelievable. I mean, we were pushed to the limit. So was the tabloid industry, the whole of the print industry, and you know, all of these industries. It wasn't maybe a nice place to work in, but the creativity was really something else, I think, back there. And I wonder if it's because of that, because the conflicts, there were so many conflicts, people genuinely were shouting and screaming at each other, which was quite horrific. But the bit in your book that you write about with this, which is interesting, is the bit with the bands. If you want art, you want creativity, quite often bands are in conflict with each other, and it's the ones which have healthy conflict can survive that. Alan McGee was interviewed on this podcast, and he obviously worked with Oasis and he worked with the Libertines, and he said the two greatest bands that he worked with, they were in fighting each other all the time, and that was, he really believes that's one of the reasons that they created such a great big, you know, scene around them and created those records that people loved.
Right. Oh, well, that's great. I probably should have talked to him, because yeah, that's a big kind of theme. And I had that whole chapter on rock bands because I was speaking to a guy. He's a guy called Warren Zanes, who's he used to be a good friend of Tom Petty's, and he was also in a band himself called the Del Fuegos. And he's worked in the music industry basically kind of for 30 years, been in and around bands for 30 or 40 years. And he said to me, and he's very shrewd, very wise observer of these things. And he said to me in a conversation, you know, my experience, the bands that are going to be successful are not the ones who I see high-fiving each other after every gig and saying, you are amazing, man, I love you. they'll have a nice time and then they'll split up, you know, or they won't go anywhere and they'll fail. The bands that are really successful, like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and you know, he knew very well, are the bands who have learnt to have their disagreements out in the open and still respect each other, right? Where they know, you know, there's a kind of very clear understanding of who's good at what and why you're in the band. And that respect enables you to say, no, I don't agree with this. I talked to the guy who managed REM, right? And he was REM's manager, you know, during their long part of their early years of success. And he said, actually, right throughout most of their career. And he said, they talked and they disagreed very politely because they were, you know, very nice. They're all very nice men, basically, about everything. You know, every decision they made was hashed out. It was almost like a sort of little mini parliament, you know. If at the end of the discussion, if one of them disagreed with a decision, they had a veto. They could say, right, I know you all think this, but we're not doing it because I don't want to do it. And that sustained them for whatever it was, 25 years at the top. So very interesting subject to me.
Yeah, I've watched Pistol on... is that Disney Plus? Yeah. And so I've gone back looking through, I'm reading England's Dreamy again at the moment, and I've gone back and watching all the documentaries on the Pistols and punk and stuff like that. And that scene was amazing. But one of the things you can, because it's such a perfect storm of everything happening at the same time to create that music movement and fashion and everything else. But one of the great things you hear is they'll just say you take the Pistols, they all just argued with each other constantly. They just didn't get on, and I think they kind of needed that to create that animosity with each other, which created the whole scene and what happened. Yeah, I think that's what you need.
And, and different bands will do it in different ways, right? So they did it in a kind of like angry and acrimonious way, and it was sparks flew, and they were brilliant, and they kind of were successful, and then they kind of flame out. Other bands are like REM, where everything's quite kind of polite, but still, you know, they're open about their disagreements. They don't avoid it, but they just do it politely. Bands like the Rolling Stones, you know, Mick and Keith will have disagreements, and now and again they'll hit each other, but they have worked out a way to just keep that conversation, that their disagreements, going for, you know, whatever it is, 50 years now. So different, you'll have different cultures of disagreement, but the good ones will all find a way to have their disagreements out in the open. And back to your experience of being in the 90s, you know, 90s workplace of people screaming at each other, I'm sure there's a huge amount of creativity that came out of that. And I think that has absolutely, that almost certainly was part of the creativity, right? The fact that people were able to have these arguments. When in an argument, you are actually thinking really, really hard and fast about how to, you know, defend your idea or tear down the other person's idea. And that, in the right circumstances, will lead to brilliant, better ideas and better insights. Now, I don't think that necessarily means, you know, we should go back to the way it was in your workplace, because I'm sure, and you hinted at it, you know, there were downsides too, right? And some people did get hurt, and maybe it was exclusive of certain people, you know, in more introverted people, maybe of women too, maybe it was, I don't know, you know, perhaps it was quite male dominated, but some of these workplaces were, right? The ones that celebrated the kind of confrontational stuff. So it doesn't have to necessarily be like that, but we can take the idea that a creative workplace is one where the people in the workplace feel free to have open disagreements that sometimes get quite passionate. We can take that idea and say, yeah, we need more of that.
In fairness, the company I was talking about was Planet 24, and they were very inclusive to everyone. They just employed.
Right.
I thought they were very good with their employment. They employed lots of women and at a time. Yeah. And I don't think it ever crossed the line. I just think it was a different culture. When I moved, though, and I started doing Soccer AM, I just said to all the guys, I want to be friends with everyone rather than enemies, because it was quite aggressive.
It can be quite intense. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we still got the same creativity, but we all got on with each other, which was a much nicer way. But we did have a democracy where we would all say, do we think this is a good idea? And then I was the boss, so I made the decisions. But I would ask a lot. And I think it's a good idea to get people's opinions. And I've done this on this podcast, get everyone's opinions and make their opinions worthwhile in an argument. But then someone possibly has to make a decision in the end of the day. But it's nice to hear people's views. Putting your advertising brain back on for a minute, it must have been, you know, you look at a band like say Oasis, it would be incredible, wouldn't it, when you're looking at two brothers fighting like that, like the world's going, oh no, Oasis, and but the media love it. And as a, for an advertising brain, you're probably going, this is going to sell records. I can't. I mean, when they get back together again, which they will do one day for the cash, it's going to be explosive again, isn't it? Things like that is what it sells a band, doesn't it?
It's true, and people like Alan McGee are actually brilliant advertising people. You know, not literally in the sense of making ads, but they are people who understand the power of a great story. Having said that, none of it would be great advertising or great branding if it didn't lead to really brilliant ideas and brilliant music in the case of Oasis, right? So the main reason that conflict in Oasis was productive was that it led to this incredible music and this incredible combination of Liam and Noel's voices and you know, in every sense of that word. Yeah, it's a good story, but the story is not really the important thing. It's the conflict and disagreement leading to creativity, which I think is the really interesting story there.
Yeah, and Nicky Wire once said to me that I should get him on this podcast actually, but he said to me music is about ideas. Good music is about ideas, not about how well you can play your instruments. And it's so true. And I think that, you know, when I'm listening back to the whole punk thing, they all came at it from different angles, from listening to different music, generally similar-ish sort of stuff, but they were arguing about what music was good and what music was bad, and they created their own thing. And I'm sure that happens with most bands, is they come with their influences and then they're all sitting there in a room and someone's going, no, I think blah, the Beatles, in the case of the Sex Pistols, I think the Beatles are crap and I think this is crap and I like this. And I think that then you can kind of find out your road to making your music and your art.
Yeah, and look, the whole process of musical creativity is very much like a disagreement. You know, you bring together, I don't know, black soul music with white rock, and you get something new. It's almost like these two musical traditions are allowed to have an argument and have it out, and actually something new is created. That's the same process in any like really healthy disagreement, is you have two different points of view rather than musical traditions, but you have two different opinions of points of view, and the best thing that can happen is not that they cancel each other out, but they lead to something new, that they create a new kind of third space for people to go to. I actually think there's a huge parallel between the way musical creativity works and the way that disagreement can be creative.
Ian, you're talking my language there. When Jamaican ska met British punk, you ended up with the two-tone label, and that's the greatest thing which ever happened in my mind. And I'm sitting looking at, as my listeners know, I'm sitting looking at my specials picture on the wall now, and it's I always love that. I love the conversations I could sit and read about two-tone label all day long. Just a final one on the music. I'm always fascinated by the Beatles, and I'm fascinated by the fact that they had two front men. And they created such an amazing array of music, and they're so influential in so many different ways. But there was a power shift between them constantly, wasn't there? It was Lennon's band to begin with, and you talk about this in your book, and then McCartney, you know, he wanted a slice of it, I suppose. And I've done this on the podcast, Will Storr, when he talked about the status game, how McCartney ends up after John Lennon dies trying to change the Lennon-McCartney round to McCartney-Lennon because of that sort of status game. But during the time they were together, there was still some conflicts going on there, wasn't there?
Well, you know, funnily enough, it's a subject very dear to my heart. I'm a huge Beatles fan. And in fact, the book I'm writing at the moment, my new book, won't be finished for another couple of years, is about the John and Paul relationship. So I'm writing about Lennon McCartney. You're right. To me, there's an interesting distinction to be drawn here, because in their songwriting partnership, people always say, yeah, they're really competitive. That's true. But what I think is interesting is, at least when it was working really well, the competition was between ideas for songs. It was between songs. It wasn't between them. I actually don't think Paul was out to prove I'm better than John Lennon. He thought John Lennon was wonderful. He thought he was absolutely brilliant. John Lennon thought Paul McCartney was wonderful. He thought McCartney was brilliant. But did he come in every day thinking, hey, I've got a song here that's even better than Paul's. And then did Paul come in and do the same thing the next day? Yes. So in a way, it's a great model for a disagreement, because I think what they showed us is, let the disagreement be about the thing, you know, the thing that's important, which is your idea, you know, or your song in that case. It doesn't have to be really personal and competition. It doesn't have to be, I'm better than you. I don't think that's how John and Paul thought about it at all.
Did you watch the documentary of course you must have done, on Disney Plus?
Yes, and I wrote a 5,000-word essay on it, which you can find at my Substack, The Ruffian, called "The Banality of Genius," which I self-published it, and it went absolutely insanely viral. Yes, you can be assured I know it pretty well, and it inspired me to write this long piece. I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
I just loved it. I sat down and started watching it, and I just couldn't get enough of just, he's like, you, I like the same as you, I like looking at humans. I find humans fascinating. And to watch four of the most talented people in a room, or four very talented people in a room, just the way they're operating and their body language, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And I like the Beatles, but I became a Beatles fan after watching the documentary.
Right. I'm glad to hear that. I'm delighted to hear that, because but part of the reason I wrote my book, when I'm writing my book, not just for hardcore Beatles fans, you know, I want my book to be read by people who quite like the Beatles, but the kind of person who watched that film and thought, this is fascinating. Because I honestly do think, once anybody gets into the story of the Beatles, gets into the personality dynamics and so on, I think it's fascinating whether or not you're into the music or not. It's absolutely, you know, just inexhaustibly interesting. So I'm always glad when I hear people say, well, I wasn't particularly in the Beatles, and then I watched Get Back, this kind of ridiculously long 8-hour documentary, and I watched every second of it because it was so riveting. Because it just reaffirms my theory, which is actually the Beatles are just the most incredible story that anybody's ever, you know, has ever happened. And there's so much more to say about it. I wrote about the Get Back thing. I'll send you the piece. And it will really kind of feed into my book about the relationship between the two of them, because I thought that was the kind of emotional heart of it, was, you know, the relationship between John and Paul.
I think it's one of the best documentaries I've ever watched, just because I just couldn't believe that I was getting access to just watch them be normal, be them. And, you know, because normally everything's played up for the cameras, or it's like, at this stage, the Rolling Stones did that, or there's a sit-down interview. There's one at the moment there's a lot of Rolling Stones stuff at the moment, and Jagger's sitting down having a chat. It's not like that. You're just watching them talk, and the body language is amazing. And then the way they're looking, the way Yoko's interacting with them, and then there's the Hare Krishna, and, you know, George Harrison goes off. I loved every minute of it. I just thought it was just fantastic. I couldn't get enough of it. If they'd done 30 hours, I'd watched all 30 hours. I just thought it was absolutely amazing. Have you managed to get any access to Paul, or will you be able to get any access to him?
No, I don't particularly want to get. I mean, I would love to meet him for other reasons.
Right.
But it would sort of unbalance the book a bit. You know, it's a book about John and Paul. If it was the Paul McCartney official, you know, endorsed version of what happened, it wouldn't feel right. So I'm quite happy not to talk to him. And so I'm just really kind of digging into the incredible amount of published material, whether it's books or articles or videos and film, that's already out there. There's plenty to go on. So that's what I'm working my way through at the moment.
Ian, thank you so much for joining me. You have to promise me when that book's out, you'll come back on the podcast to promote it, because I really want to talk to you about that.
Of course, I would love to.
More insight into those two. Your book, How to Disagree, is out now. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. I think it's great. We really haven't just touched the side yet, have we? There's so much great stuff in there about interrogation and all sorts of different stuff. So I recommend that. It's a good book if you want to learn how to talk to people around you and actually to understand what they're feeling as well. I think that's the important thing which came across when I was reading it, that everybody in an argument thinks they're right, basically. So you've got to understand they're from a position of they think they're right. And that's the way it works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ian, if people want to follow you, where's the best place to go? You've just mentioned your Substack there. Just mention that again. What was that one?
Yeah, so my Substack is called The Ruffian. And if you just Google my name and Substack, or Google my name, Ian Leslie and The Ruffian, You'll find it. And I'm on Twitter at Mr. Ian Leslie. And yeah, that's about it.
Ian, thank you so much for joining me today. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Real pleasure. Thank you very much, Tim.